I got pushed into a wall head first. And it took them 3 class periods to figure out I had a concussion. That's how much I was bringing to the table. I mean, 2 teachers didn't even notice. And the third one was like, he wasn't facing forward. And that's when I realized he's one of the better facer forwards I've ever had. So I knew.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. That bit you just heard was from Nate Bargatze, a Tennessee comedian who has a new special on Netflix called The Greatest Average American. He takes pride in his averageness. He and his wife met when they were both working at an Applebee's. His humor is family friendly, but there's a sharp mind underneath it. He thinks about the normal stuff in life harder than most of us do. And that comes out, not just in his material, but in our conversation. Here's my talk with Nate Bargatze. So, Nate Bargatze, I wanted to ask, first of all, about this. We've had other comedians on this show. We've had other Tennesseans. We have never had a Vanderbilt fan. This is like seeing a white rhino in the wild. You know, it's a rare experience. Could you tell us how this happened?
So I grew up growing up in Nashville. I had my cousin Ronnie Bargatze coached at Vanderbilt in the 70s, and it was the color commentator. My mom worked at Vanderbilt. So we had some ties with Vanderbilt. So that's where, like, we kind of, you know, became big fans. And, you know, before the Titans came to Tennessee, you know, all college sports was all you had. So most everybody was Tennessee fans growing up, all my friends. They didn't want to stick it, you know, like stick in there and have to grind it out as a Vandy fan. So I became a huge Vandy fan. And
well, I was going to say, so I'll, full disclosure, I went to UGA. I'm a UGA guy. And so I, you know, we've had our own disappointments and heartbreaks, but sort of on a different level. And I'm trying to imagine like what are some of the, like, if you had the Vanderbilt sports highlights reel of your life, what would be on it?
Us winning the College World Series.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
I was in Charlotte, North Carolina when that happened. And I was at the Comedy Zone, and then I was watching the games. And then afterwards we went to some bar and I watched it on one of those old big TVs, like the ones that are like, you know, like 2 feet thick. Like just an old, your first big screen. And I found one and I just found it at a bar and I went and watched it. And so that one and our first bowl win was when we went 2008, when we went to the bowl, was very big. I went to that game. And I have a joke about that. That's the game that I went into early and got stuck inside the game. This side of Titans Stadium.
Stuck way before it started.
Oh, like,
right?
3 hours. Yeah. So I was in there alone for 3 hours. So that one is big. And then, those are big ones. You know, it's funny. Georgia, us beating, we beat Georgia in football on the day I got married, 2006. I got married on Friday the 13th, actually in October. But I got married on a Friday to avoid college football Saturday.
Of course.
And so I always thought Vanderbilt rewarded me the next day with beating Georgia and at Georgia. And then we beat them again at our 10-year anniversary. And those are the only 2 times we beat them lately.
Those are our gifts to you. And at 20, you. At 25, you'll get another one.
Thank you.
So I wanted to ask about the special, which was obviously done sort of under COVID rules.
Yeah.
And could you just kind of explain how y'all put that together?
Yeah, I didn't think I was going to get a tape special this year. I really wanted to. And then, but, you know, COVID, all that stuff. And so then Netflix kind of came to us and was like, look, we found a way to able to do it safely. Everybody had to get COVID tested. They did it outside. It was only 100 people. So we did that. And so it came together and it ended up, you know, with a lot of stuff that went on during it. But
yeah, you had helicopters going by about every 5 minutes, it felt like.
We found out later there was a police chase. And that's
really?
Why. Yeah, because it was like, you know, there's helicopters in a lot in L.A., but, you know, it was like, not this much, like not over us. And we found out later it was a police chase, and that's why there were so many.
Well, I know before that you had done a run of shows at like drive-in theaters, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering, you know, between that and the special you taped, I know for comedians, such a big part of the experience is getting feedback from the audience and sort of playing off of that and figuring it out where to go or whether to extend a joke or cut it off or whatever. Were you able to do that at all with the crowds that either had their masks on or they were in cars? I mean, how did you process how it was going?
It was tough. Luckily, what you did was some of the jokes I knew already, so you kind of know that they work. People would sit out front, so like in the front rows, people could kind of sit in front of their cars. So you could at least hear, you could sometimes hear like a little something. Also, in Chicago, we had people honked for laughs. So instead of laughing, they would just like beep, 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 beep. And that actually kind of worked.
Really?
Because it was like you realized, you know, it's not really the laughing. You need the response. The response that's what you're kind of building your timing off of. And so that kind of worked when we did it like that. And so it ended up being pretty, you know, it was not easy. It was not something I really enjoyed the drive-ins. I mean, you had to deal with so much stuff. We had to deal with, there was a train in Cleveland. I mean, just like a speed train that would just go by, you know, not like one that like you see like hobos jump on. It was like one that's like, yeah, like just flying. And so that would happen during the show. And then when that happened, you couldn't even hear yourself talk. And so a lot of that, you just got to trust that it's working. But we got used to it. And then they, you know, it was definitely, it was something I really enjoyed doing. I'm not saying I would want to, you know, you don't want to go make a career out of it, but it's definitely was a pretty neat experience.
And you had the occasion of having every once in a while at one of these shows, somebody leave in the middle, right? And there's no way to do that.
Oh yeah.
Quietly at a drive-in.
No, you see like just headlights from a Ford F-150 hit you in the face and you just like, go. And I mean, dude, he was in Butler, Pennsylvania, and we're watching him just drive back and forth. Like he couldn't figure out how to get out of the exit. You know, those drive-ins are kind of hard to figure out how to get out of. And so you just watched him just drive back and forth and you're like, oh God, he just, if it's just like a real, like a loud truck, and you're like, all right.
So I know that obviously most comedians, I assume you probably do this, kind of work out your material in clubs first, trying to figure out what works, take notes and stuff. I assume you didn't get the chance to do that, except before you went out on the kind of the drive-in tour. Was that where you worked on the stuff for the special, or were you able to do something else?
So I had about 45 minutes before COVID. So I was already doing. And so I was kind of lucky. And like, otherwise, I don't know if I would have done a special just because I wouldn't have been able to really try it like I wanted to. But I had enough like that I've already kind of did a bunch of shows with. So I was able to kind of like be like, all right, I got most of it. And then I had some COVID stuff that I opened with like COVID jokes because it was like, what are you going to do? I mean, you're taping a special outside. Everybody's got masks on. Like, I don't, you know, it's like.
You can't just ignore it, right?
You can't ignore it. And it's kind of, it is the time that we were in. And I didn't want to do a whole special on COVID, but it was like, you just try to make some jokes about the moment that we were in.
Most people who know you and have followed your career know your dad still is a magician. And I saw some clips of him as I was doing research for this. He's very funny. And I'm wondering what it was about what he did that made you decide you wanted to perform.
You know, I don't know if I thought about it like when I was growing up, but now that I see it, just the fact that your dad's performing is like, it's such a unique kind of thing to grow up with. And so, yeah, I think it like just seeped into me. And I would do some shows with him when I was a kid. We'd always do, you know, a couple with him. He came to my kindergarten and did a show when he was a clown. He was a clown and he would dress up as a clown at the beginning. And then now he just does magic. He hasn't been a clown for 30 years, but at the beginning he would be a clown. And I gave one of his whole tricks away. I like when he wanted me to help him But I was like five. And then when I got in front of all the kids, I was like, I'm not doing this. And so I sat behind him, which then I could see the trick, how the trick worked. So I just called it out. It was like this old kids trick where these dogs, and their audience only sees one dog, but there's two dogs. And so I just yelled, I was like, Dad, there's two dogs. And so I just ruined the whole. That was the last magic trick I ruined. I learned pretty quickly, like, you're not supposed to do that.
Yeah, maybe I'm stretching things a little bit here, but, obviously comedy is a sort of magic. You have this stuff you say and you surprise people and it gets a reaction and stuff. I mean, do you kind of feel those parallels between what you do and what he does?
Yeah, it's very much. I mean, comedy is, it's all about surprise. And so that's what's the kind of crazy thing. That's the hard part too. Sometimes when you go do shows and people want to hear old jokes, because they yell out, like, I have a joke about Olivia.
Yes.
Where this old man sees me with no shirt on and thinks I'm his elderly wife and says, Olivia. And so people will yell out Olivia and it's like, well, you're yelling out the funniest part of that joke. So it's kind of hard to redo the joke when you're like, you're yelling out the surprise. Some jokes you can tell over and over. People like hear them. I almost look at them. They're kind of like songs. They're just like, if it's a long story and people don't mind hearing the rhythm of it again and stuff like that. But yeah, it's very much like that. It's a surprise. It's, you're trying to not let the audience see where you're going with a joke. You don't want, you don't want them to figure it out before you do.
I know a lot of people in show business don't want their kids to be in show business because it's a hard way to make a living. Did he try to warn you off of it or did he give you advice, that sort of thing?
No, they were super, super supportive and super, super excited. I mean, I helped out with no college promises. Like there was not like a degree I was like letting go by. It was I was doing whatever job I had, I could go back to. I was doing nothing. So they were so, so supportive of me doing it. He was very, very, they both my parents were just very, they were very used to that lifestyle, where you make, it's like a comedy, you make money by like the gig you get. Like, you're like, you can afford something because you're like, all right, I'm making $500 next week so we can go out to eat because I've got this coming, whatever. So I grew up living like that. Where it was like my dad had a bunch of Christmas shows. We had an awesome Christmas one year because he had like the whole month he did shows. And so they were very used to that kind of lifestyle. My wife's parents, who I've been with before I started comedy, that they had to get used to it because that was a very different lifestyle that they knew. But I was very fortunate. Then they were supportive too. They weren't bad, but I was lucky that my parents were, they helped me out so much.
You mentioned not having a college thing going on and you joke a lot about your low test scores in high school and sort of washing out of community college and all that sort of thing. And how your wife every once in a while will say you're dumb. You're clearly not dumb. And I just wonder if you've thought about why you struggled so much in school.
I think about it a lot. Think about it every day. Wake up every day. Think about it. I don't know. It's like stuff. I don't know. It's like, it's just like, like if you're street smart versus book smart, like I'm just not book smart. Stuff didn't stick with me for whatever reason. I don't remember like a lot of things I don't remember. It's kind of in the moment. I think very in the moment. And then now when you remember your act, I always, me and my wife talk about it, but it's like, I almost think you have so much, you have to remember so much material that like stuff just gets pushed out. And so I just don't think stuff didn't stick with me like it did. I listen to people all the time. They'll be like, my wife last night was talking about, she remembered some dress. She's like, she saw a dress. She's like, I remember wearing that in eighth grade. And I'm like, I could not tell you one thing I wore. I mean, maybe that's a guy, like I'm just wearing nothing in eighth grade. Like who cares? But I just don't remember. Stuff just doesn't stick with me that way.
But the routines stick with you.
Those do. I mean, and I feel like it's like you, because it's maybe it's something that you love. So you tend to, there was a time, so Vanderbilt, when I did go to community college for my 1 year with no credits, I took speech and I gave a speech And I just talked about Vanderbilt's 1996 football season.
And that has to be the only speech of that kind in history.
I mean, no one cared. And I mean, we went 5-6 that year. So it wasn't even like a big year. And I had a highlight reel of, because my mom was working at Vanderbilt. So she's able to get a highlight reel of that season. And I kind of showed that season. At that point, I could name every football player. I could name everybody. It was like, if I truly, what I learned, and I've learned with comedy, if you really love something, you can really learn a lot about it. And you remember it. But you got to really love it. So there's so many things that I don't think I care about. And so I don't, like, you know, they don't stick with me.
When did you learn that you loved comedy? Was that from your dad, or was it before that or after that somewhere?
I remember we watched Sinbad when I was a kid. And I remember, like, just, you know, it was just so funny. And I remember watching this special. And then it was, you know, in high school, you know, it's funny, in high school, they asked where we were going to be in 10 years. And I did write, I was going to perform at Zany's or Comedy Club in Nashville. And I did do that in 10 years. But I always think, like, I guess subconsciously, I had to want to do this. But I set out with this big dream of going, like, I'm going to be a stand-up comedian. It was just, I was, you know, you'd make a lot of jokes in school. I came second place in class clown, so it wasn't even first place. And it was like, you just got, I don't know, you just, I went and saw Jim Brewer live at Zany's. And I mean, that was probably one of them, seeing him when I was actually there. And it was just so good. He jumped in the crowd when he left, and it just, like, all these things, like, stuck with me, and he was making everybody laugh. And it was kind of like then when I was like, God, this is awesome to be able to do this. And I loved it. And then once you start doing it, you just kind of get addicted to it. Like, you just, it's so fun. And making a new joke work, new jokes are what keep you kind of going. Cause when you can get a new joke, it's the greatest thing. When you get, I mean, laughing off something new, cause every time you do a special, like right now, I'm trying to come up with a new hour. And I mean, you just are like, I cannot come up with a new hour. There's so many moments you're like, dude, I am probably the worst comedian that's ever lived. And you just feel like, I don't know how I'm going to do this again. But then you just slowly do it. And you just, you know, it's almost good to be put yourself, you know, in a corner where you're like, I don't know what, I gotta figure something out. These people are coming. I can't do these same jokes. And so you just put yourself in a corner, and then you just start coming up with new stuff.
My parents used to watch a show called Rescue 911, and it would just show reenactments of crimes, and it was powerful. I've seen 3 seconds of Rescue 911. I remember walking through the living room, my parents are watching it, I look at the TV, a guy has a ski mask on, and a woman is asleep with her feet out from under the covers, and he started rubbing her foot. That's all I saw. I kept walking. I don't know what happened before or after, but I know I've never been able to sleep with my feet out from under the covers. Because I accidentally saw that 30 years ago. I'll be in a hotel room, and I'm like, look, you can't get in here, dude. You've locked everything. And I'm like, that's exactly what he's been waiting for. He's probably already in here.
When we come back, Nate Bargatze talks about navigating humor when his young daughter is part of the joke.
You know, I always talk to her about stuff because I want to be a dad. I don't want her to be scared to come to me and talk to me about something, you know, that she would wants to talk to her dad about because she thinks I'm going to go tell everybody about it.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Hey, y'all. If you're a fan of Southbound, then you're going to want to check out WFAE Studios, a new podcast feed with investigative series, public conversations, and special reports from WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source. It's a place where you'll find projects like Asbestos Town, David Borax's recent series on an old textile mill in Davidson, North Carolina, that's dragging up some painful memories. Get a deep look at the news that impacts our community. Make sure to follow WFAE Studios on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or your favorite listening app. Now, back to Southbound and my conversation with Nate Bargatze. So I want to ask, one of the things about you is that you don't curse in your comedy. I don't know what I heard you call yourself a comics parents comic one time. Was that a conscious decision, or was that just as you were starting out, that's just how your material ended up?
It was, I was going to be clean because I didn't, my parents would kill me. And so I knew I couldn't, I would be too embarrassed to be dirty in front of my parents. It was really for them. And I knew I couldn't, I just couldn't be dirty. I mean, I see comics and they'll be dirty. And I mean, like most of my favorite comics are dirty, but I'll see them and their parents will be there. And I'm like, how do you say this stuff in front of them, dude? Like, that's so crazy. And so it's like just living like that, like, you know, growing up that way is how I started. And then I always just stuck with it. And it's actually worked in my favor now just because there's not that many clean comedians and it's not happening as much as it. I feel like, you know, not to tell, I don't care if a comic's clean or not clean, but just like a business standpoint of it, it's not bad to be able to do because it just puts you in a, you can do anything. You can perform anywhere. And I moved to New York, and so I learned how to be clean in New York, and being clean there, I mean, it was hard because I was doing like midnight shows that were these uncensored, you know, midnight show, and then I'm up there talking about parking or something, like, you know, just nonsense. But you had to be able to tell these jokes, and I didn't want the audience to be like, oh, this guy's clean, you know, so it was almost like trying to kind of hide it. And so I was, my favorite thing is when a comic or when someone is like, oh, I didn't realize you were clean. And that's what you're kind of going for. It's like you want them to just be, you know, and I think the great dirty comics are like that, where you could go like, oh, yeah, they are pretty dirty or they curse a lot. I didn't really think about it because it's just you like the material.
Yeah. So you called your special The Greatest Average American and you didn't really elaborate on it much during the set. But I assume that means you feel like that's sort of what you are. So what does that sort of, what does that mean to you?
Yeah. So we got the name after it. So if I knew it was going to be called that before, I might've done something with it. I've said that before. So like when they come up with a name, especially at Netflix, it's like the name is kind of important. Like you're supposed to, in the title, kind of be able to like say, what is this comedy special about? So the last one was The Tennessee Kid. And it's just kind of like, yeah, I'm from Tennessee. And like, that's what it is. And so this one I've like joked about, and like on our podcast, I joked about it, like being, I'm the greatest average American. And I was like, cause I have just very average taste. I like chain restaurants. I do everything at, like, you know, any music, if it's the top 40, I'm probably on board with it. I like all just whatever everybody else is on board with. So I would always just joke that I think I'm the greatest average American. Is like every poll that you see, you're like, yeah, you're right on. I'm right on board with all the polls. You know, so it's like, I just always thought that, but I do think my act kind of, you know, I talk a lot about in the past, either McDonald's or Walmart or, you know, whatever it is being married. And it's just, you know, I live in Tennessee and, you know, just, I don't know, like you're the middle of the country.
I know sometimes, kind of diving into a joke can ruin it sometimes, and I hope you'll indulge me a little bit. I want to dive a little bit into a joke you told on the in the Tennessee Kid special about when your dog died. So you have a several minute bit about this, very funny, where you manage to, in the course of talking about this kind of terrible event, make fun of your wife and your daughter and even the dog.
And she was bred to be a hunting dog, and she was just like a misfit toy that just couldn't, that didn't do it. She got shot once, and that's because the guy, like, she would like, he would be like doing target practice, and then she'd just walk in front of the targets, and he would like hit her, and he's like, what are you doing? And she's like, what are you doing?
And so obviously, you know, as you talk about it, it's clearly a traumatic event, especially to your daughter. But you managed to make sort of humor out of it that not only that was warm, but not like maudlin and sickly sweet. You didn't have everybody like weeping over your dog and that sort of thing. And I guess I want to ask sort of at what point in that process as all that was happening, did you start to think, well, maybe there's something in here for me to tell a story about?
It was after it all happened. And when I do write jokes, it's like, I don't ever want, you know, they always say, like I used to, I've done a lot of shows for the troops. And so like an easy trick is you could say, like, I perform for the troops and the audience claps, but it's always like a cheap clap. Like, you know, and sometimes like, so I've told jokes about that and I would say that very quickly. So I didn't want that cheap laugh for the, or the cheap applause or the, you know, it's like, it should be about the material. And it was just about a real, like a, you know, a parent thing that you have to deal with your kid. And there, you know, our daughter was five and she was, this dog was perfect for a five-year-old. She would lay on this dog. She loved this dog. And it's the first thing that she can really wrap her head around, and she's really upset. So I was like, how can I tell this story? Cause it was like, you just know that like every parent's having to deal with this. So it was like, when it happened, it was just like, how do I describe it? How do I tell it with, you know, with people not feeling that way? And so I ended up just trying it, and you got to just figure a way to, you know, make something funny. That's not a funny moment. It's a sad moment. So you got to show some, you know, a lot of this too, the wife jokes, like, you got to show love. You got to show that you're, you know, sometimes if someone, because when I first started doing wife material, people would take it like, why are you even married? It seems like you hate your wife. And you're like, well, that's not the point. You know, I don't tell you about all the great stuff that me and my wife have, or the great relationship that we have, and that I do love her, because that's not funny. That's not what the job, but I do need to portray that so you don't take it that way. And so it's all that with the dog, of just like this experience of dealing with Annie, our dog that died, and then able to do it in a way that's funny. And so that was kind of, and I liked that. I liked talking about it. It was kind of different. You know, it was like, I don't think I've really heard someone talk about it that way. And so it was like, you know, really talking about it, like, how do we explain this to our daughter and how she dealt with it? So it was just kind of a different way to kind of talk about something, but it was a way that it was something that I knew that a lot of people had to deal with.
And did you tell your daughter that at some point down the road, like, I'm going to be talking about this on stage and that sort of thing?
I'll tell her. When I first was doing it, if she was at a show, my wife would know, like, when I start talking about her, to kind of like distract her. So she wasn't hearing it at the very beginning. And then I would, you know, like, you probably do that joke for a year. And then after a year, and then we had a new dog, and then she did hear it eventually. But I would definitely talk to her about it and just, but that when I'm writing the joke, I think of that too. Like, I don't want her to not hear. I don't ever do a joke that she can't hear that is going to be, you know, I always talk to her about stuff, because I want to be a dad. I don't want her to be scared to come to me and talk to me about something, you know, that she wants to talk to her dad about, because she thinks I'm going to go tell everybody about it.
You've had her on, you know, promos for this special you're doing, a couple of little funny bits, and she seems funny too. I mean, do you sense her, your sense of humor in her at all?
She is very funny. You know, as a comedian, you always say you ask a lot. You're like, is this funny? You end up saying that a lot, because you're say something, be like, is that funny? Can I do that? So she does do that to me now, and I can see her do it to like her cousin or her friends and be like, that's funny. Or she'll say it to me like, that's funny, right? And so she does think about jokes a lot. And so I can see, you know, we're seeing a little bit more of her personality. I mean, she doesn't say she wants to be a comedian. I mean, now I've talked about in the special, all kids want to be YouTubers, and that's what they're obsessed with. And so she does, I do see a little personality in her now, and see her make some jokes and be funny. And so, yeah, she's done. I mean, I love doing all that stuff with her. I love her opening and introducing me on the specials. I want to kind of keep doing that. I really enjoy, I like doing it. It's something that I think, you know, we only have one kid, and we had a kid kind of late. So like we only have one child. And so I do want to kind of experience all this stuff with her and have her do this stuff with me, as long as she'll do them. I mean, you know, if she didn't want to do them, she likes it though.
So speaking of family and stuff, this time, you know, 13, 14 months now that we've been on this sort of COVID break from our normal routines, has it changed anything about sort of the way you want to live your life? I mean, are you going to do anything different from here forward?
No, I don't know. I mean, I think I'll go back. You know, it's like once everybody feels safe again, and you know, and you're not so scared of it. I mean, I think you go back to it, and like you want to be out and you want to go do stuff. It's been nice to be home as much as I have, because I would have been gone a lot. So I do appreciate that I got to, you know, especially my daughter's 8. I gotta very much be, you know, put her to bed every night and stuff like that, and so and be around. So that stuff is very cool, and it's a lot of time that I wouldn't have got. I think I'll take her, try to bring her out with me more, and like go do stuff. And she's getting to the age now where I can take her, and you know, like, you know, I want to go to Australia and do shows, and I've been kind of waiting for her to get a little bit older. So when you go do that stuff, then I can be like, all right, she's old enough to come, and like we bring her and let her see, you know, see the world.
At some point, I don't know if it's right away or a couple months down the road, like we said, these shows are going to be sort of normal again. And you're going to be back out performing in front of sort of the normal crowds. And people are going to be, who have been cooped up for a year or more, are going to be going to see you. And are going to be jacked about going to see anybody, but especially you. Have you thought about what that means to them and to you?
Yeah, I mean, I try to think about it a lot. You know, like, you know, that was the drive-in shows were kind of that, where it was, you know, it's not like it's all about me, but it's all about those drive-ins were like just getting people out in a safe way. And like, I know that people are going crazy and just being stuck at home and they want to go do something. And so, I mean, I think about that a lot. Like, it's, you know, it's not really, you try not to think about, you know, it's like, I don't know, they're coming to see me. I always talk about, it's always weird when you start selling out theaters and, you know, these places that I went and saw Brian Regan or Jerry Seinfeld, or you went and saw, I don't know, the Nutcracker, a play, and you're at this same venue that they were at. And I don't think I've ever seen Nutcracker, but that's the only play I can, that's the only thing I can think of.
Yeah, that was nice. That was nice to throw it in there.
But if you go see that stuff, Lion King, we saw Lion King. But if you go see that stuff, it's always kind of weird because you just think, we always say, like, when you're backstage and you're seeing everybody line up and sit down, and you have a moment where you're like, who are they? You know, you think like, who are they here to see? Like, you kind of forget that it's you. You know, and another part about not being political in my act or not being, you know, it's like, it's just about trying to have a good night out. That's, I think that gets very overlooked, and all that stuff gets mixed in with entertainment, with politics and stuff like that. You're not giving people any kind of release. And like they get a break from that stuff, that their whole life is that, you know, like people have to, their kids got to have babysitters, and I've got to have, and someone's got to have 2 jobs, and someone's got all this kind of stuff. So I shouldn't, when they come see me, I shouldn't be more like throw more heaviness on top of them. It's like, just go out and be good and be funny and give them a break.
Even after our interview was over, I was on YouTube munching on Nate Bargatze clips like they were sour cream and onion ruffles. I couldn't get enough. I think it does have something to do with what he said at the end of our conversation about people needing something that isn't full of the dread and conflict of the day. But I also think he's doing a little bit of poor mouthing in the fine Southern tradition. What comes through to me in all his jokes about dumb TSA agents and dumb baristas and his own dumb mistakes, so we're all sort of dumb together. All of us are just knocking around in the world, trying to figure things out, and none of us should pretend any different. What makes Nate Bargatze so smart, despite all his protests otherwise, is that by laughing at him, we can laugh at ourselves. And that seems like a pretty valuable thing right now. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.